This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. George Gopin doesn't take words lightly. He spent 45 years teaching literature, composition, and rhetoric, the complexities and eloquence of the English language. So when he heard President George W. Bush give a muddled speech in 2002, George Gopin felt compelled to write the White House. It was a 15-page letter, actually a one-page letter with a 14-page appendix, that criticized everything from the pace to the structure and the syntax. Well, it did bring him to the attention of GOP leaders who wanted to honor him with a number of awards. As for improving W's syntax, we'll leave that to you. Stories like that define George's career as an analyst of the English language. He's credited with a simple writing theory called the reader expectation approach. It's a set of guidelines for writing and communicating clearly based on how the reader interprets language. And it has helped countless students, corporate clients, and scientists speak and write more clearly. Today, he's a writing consultant. He's retired from teaching at Duke, where the administration let him come up with his own title, Professor Emeritus for the Practice of Rhetoric. And George Gopin joins me on the State of Things today. Welcome back, George. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Last time you were here, we were punning wildly.
Indeed.
And so that is all part of language, but only a tiny part of the story. Take us back. Born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Describe your growing up in Roxbury. You went to Roxbury Latin, right?
I did.
Talk about that.
Roxbury Latin is the country's oldest private school, founded in 1645, and a superb school. It is just marvelous today. I'm so proud of it. In my day, it was still the best in the country, but in the 1950s, that meant you were Victorian by image, and they treated us really badly. But I learned how to get tough from that, both emotionally and intellectually. We had 18 minutes for lunch. We had 3 minutes for recess. We had compulsory athletics every day. We were there from 8 to 5 and then went home and did 4 hours of homework at the age of 12. So they toughened me up that way, but they also taught me Greek and Latin and French and did a wonderful job with math. And 47 of us arrived there. Only 21 of us graduated. The rest were crushed along the way.
Well, talk about that for just a second, because those of us who have experienced that kind of classic education that you're talking about, at least in my case, didn't quite appreciate it while it was happening. How about you?
I was such a good kid who believed everything that the adults told me, that I believed that what I was going through was wonderful, and if I didn't think it was wonderful, it was my fault for not perceiving it. That's, by the way, a very good way of learning something. You know, accept it and listen to it and look around, and then later on you say, did that make any sense? And it's a nice way of being open to things you otherwise might have closed yourself off to. But the classical education for me gave me tools without which I could not have done what I eventually wound up doing.
Yeah, like what?
That is, it allowed me to see language as a system of functioning structures. Yeah. And nowadays, without the classical languages and where modern language training is reduced to where is the metro and how much does this cost, we don't have that opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you put that together with my lifelong devotion to classical music, which I've been in love with since I was 3 years old, and then you set that person studying poetry very carefully, all of a sudden you're prepared to do something about how the English language
functions. Before we get to your observations and certainly why structure matters and the fact that the language came first and later we went back and analyzed it, all of that's going to be, I think, some great conversation. But I want to take you back to that school just to get a sense of how your mind works. You talked about a 3-minute recess where you became a kind of Zen monk in a way.
I think I really think I invented Zen Buddhism in recess at Roxbury Latin. They let you out precisely at 10:12, and you had to be in your seat precisely at 10:15. And it was clear after about a week of this that if you went outside and let go for recess, like most regular human beings do, you were in trouble because you couldn't stuff it all back in by the time it got to be 10:15. So I tended to do recess alone all the time for 6 years, 36 weeks a year. And I would choose a single item to look at, a rock or the tip of the minute hand on the clock on the tower. And I would concentrate on it as hard as I could, and I found out that I could actually slow down time by doing so. That the harder I concentrated, the longer recess lasted. And by the end of 6 years, I almost was of the opinion that if I could just screw my mind tight enough, I could stop time altogether.
There you go. You're on to something there. So again, sort of looking at how things work, analyzing the process, and even imagining how time is can be constructed and reconstructed based on attention. And this, I think, is going to be a theme that's going to keep coming up throughout this conversation, where we place the attention in our writing and where words fall in a sentence. All of that's important. But still, I want to take a look at you as a student. You're an accomplished professor, writer, and a consultant. How did you do in school?
How did I do in school? Well, you know, I think I probably did really well, but it was hard to notice that at the time. Because of those 21 guys at Roxbury Latin, I was number 7 in the class. That was established after a couple of years, and it never changed. I had no hope of getting to 6 and no danger of falling to 8. And the 6 ahead of me were just so really good that I was always in competition, and we were very competitive. Yeah. With them, they split the class into the faster class half and the slower half. So I was always in the faster half. Yeah. And if you're number 7 in the faster half of 10 or 11, you're in the bottom third of the class. Mm. So as well as I did, it was a problem. I recall the advanced math board. Math was always my best subject. And 10 of us took it. And I was very proud of myself for about 12 minutes when the headmaster announced to me I had scored 788 out of 800. But after a few minutes of being with my classmates, I realized 8 of the others had scored 800, and the football quarterback had scored 778. So the class average was 796. I was 8 points below the class average.
There you
average.
Go. Like time. It's all relative.
To this day, I feel I screwed up that post.
But you never took notes or rarely took notes.
I had a strange and severe teacher, the name of Omar Shakespeare Pound. The son of the famous poet Ezra Pound.
Really?
And Omar Pound didn't like us very much, and we didn't like him very much, but he did do a couple of things that were really lastingly good. And one of them was he refused to lecture from notes, and he refused to let us take notes because, he said, too often when that is the case, the information goes from the notebook of one to the notebook of the other and through the mind of neither. And as a result, I was never an A student in anything because I didn't have all these details written down that I could memorize the night before the test. So I found myself with A minuses once I got out of Roxbury Latin on a regular basis because I really understood what the class was about at the end of the hour as opposed to having written.
Hey, seriously. Come on. Somebody in Omar's class got A's without taking notes.
Only one person really got straight A's.
Okay.
We had one guy who was just brighter than the rest of us. He's still brighter than the rest of us. He's a wonderful man as well.
You went to Brandeis as an undergraduate, right? Did you study English right off the bat?
I arrived at Brandeis not having any idea what I wanted to major in. I have never liked being cubicalized intellectually and still don't in some ways. So in orientation week, I sat down with the course catalog and made a very wide list of all the departments and then went through all the courses in each department and listed vertically under the department's name the numbers of the courses that I might be intellectually engaged by and decided in advance I would major in the longest list. And I was astonished when it was English and thought, well, I'll sign up as an English major and I'll change to my real major when I discover what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody back then changed majors 2, 3, 4 times. 50-something percent of my class wound up psych majors. It was, that moment in history, mid-60s. But I never changed because I never found anything else that seemed better.
But you said you were good at math. I mean, why go through the catalog exercise when you already felt like you were good at math?
I knew from a very young age that being good at something did not mean you should go do it for a living. And I thought that the geniuses that I could see in the math field, I didn't know if I was a genius. I didn't think I was. I was just pretty darn competent.
You only got a 786, for goodness sake.
Well, there you go. It shows failure right there. I missed one of those questions. But, for instance, in music, I was pretty good on the piano, young. Mm. But age 11, I decided I was not going to be a concert pianist because the joy I took in music would disappear if I did it for a living.
What he did for a living was write and teach others to do it and also appreciate literature. George Gopin is Professor Emeritus of the Practice of Rhetoric from Duke University. We'll talk more with him as our meet continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking this hour with George Gopin, lifelong English composition, literature, and rhetoric teacher. He's created a writing theory called the Reader's Expectation Approach and helps students, lawyers, scientists, experts in a lot of fields who are really, really smart write what they mean and mean what they write. And we will talk more about that. But before the break, we're talking about going to Brandeis. You did postgraduate work at Harvard, right? Tell us about that.
I went off to the Harvard Law School because at the end of 4 years of college, again, not knowing what I wanted to major in, I asked my father, who was a wise, gentle, lovely man, what should I do? And he said, if you haven't figured out what to do after college, you go to law school. And he gave three reasons for it, which I've passed on to hundreds and hundreds of students and advisees. He said, number one, it will train your mind in a way that nothing else will train your mind, and you will be grateful for that in everything you do in life. He was right. Number two, if you find you love it, you're problem solved. And number three, if you find you can't stand the idea of being a lawyer, the reasons why you can't stand it will inform you what it is you need from the profession you should choose. And I wound up in that third category, and it worked out very well for me. I loved the Harvard Law School. I thought it was the best teaching I had encountered. And the first year was the most exciting intellectual experience educationally that I'd had.
Was that because of that sort of that rigorous structure, the way that the mind has to kind of frame questions?
The thing I liked best about it was the way it taught you that after you had analyzed with your really strong, constructed mind the situation from this point of view, move around 180 degrees and look at it from the other side, and I'll figure out how you could make an argument for it exactly the opposite as before. I found that intriguing, and they taught me how to do that.
Well, apparently you came to the attention of your professors as well because of the way your mind worked. There was a philosophical question that one of your professors put to you, and it, apparently you gave him a unique answer.
It was a moment that actually changed my life. We were divided into moot court groups, clubs, for the moot court experience of first year, and we met once a month, and we would have a professor in who would engage with us after lunch. And Charles Nesson stood up after one of our lunches and said, here's a hypothetical. You are driving. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's Iowa. It's completely flat. It's completely clear. You can see for miles in any direction. There are no cars. There are no cops. You come to a red light. You stop. If you stop at that red light, tell me, why do you stop at that red light? And my classmates and clubmates offered any number of the obvious answers. And I waited till the end and raised my hand, and I said, you stop at the red light, because if you did not, the universe, the order in the universe would be destroyed. The universe would never be the same again. And he said, expand. And I said, well, it's like the great chain of being that was believed in Renaissance times. Everything was linked up in a precise way, and if you break the linkage, the whole structure falls apart. Everything you do in life will happen 11 seconds earlier if you go through that red light than if you stop at it, and this will throw off who you are supposed to be and how you fit into destiny. And when it was over, he came up to me and said, would you like to be my research assistant? And I did that for a year and a half. And then 10 years later, when I went back to my 10th reunion, my feet carried me through the tunnels that connect the Harvard Law buildings. I had no idea where I was going. around this corner, take that light, this left, through that double door, up those stairs, and I found myself at Charlie's office. I was astonished. And he was there, 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And we had a chat, and I told him I was into legal writing. And he said, well, we have to decide what we're doing with legal writing here, so we'll call you in as a consultant. So eight months later, they flew me in from Chicago for lunch, and I gave them some advice. And then a year after that, they hired me to teach 1 week in their 3 week winter term. And then a year and a half after that, they said, we like it. And they brought me back to teach a full winter term course in legal writing for 4 years.
Well, and talk about that and the theory that I mean, the problem for legal writers that you were trying to solve as a consultant.
Well, the problem for any professional writer, I started off with law because I had the degree in it, but now I do mostly scientists, is that we were given a model of understanding and demonstrating that we understand when we were students, that if we show we know the material, then we do okay. And to show that, all you have to do is get stuff down on the page, if you're writing somewhere, and teacher knows how to combine those things. Mm. So we don't have to be in charge of combining them ourselves. If you get down 1492 and Ocean Blue and Christopher Columbus, teacher will know how to put that together even if you do not yet understand. So we graduate from school for the last time thinking that if we can just somehow empty the stuff we've gotten in our heads onto the paper, the teacher, the great reader, will understand. And we don't realize it's not teacher, that we have become the teacher. So we have to figure out how to control readers' responses so that the interpretation of our sentence will be, amongst 97% of our readers, that which we want it to be.
And this gets to the rules of language, which, you know, for those of us who used to have to diagram sentences and enjoyed it, that was kind of a great time. Nobody does it anymore, but that means, and part of it was because, well, what's the structure stuff? I mean, language changes all the time, and so why don't we just use the language and then we'll, you know, there's no point in going back and diagramming. But you make the point that these rules of structure evolved to make us better communicators.
And they change from, certainly change from language to language. Languages are very different in the expectations readers have about them. But they change over time. Mm-hmm. We do things, one thing, exactly the opposite from what the 18th century did in English in terms of keeping the subject and verb together. Nowadays, if the subject and verb aren't together, we get into a lot of trouble because the stuff that intervenes is read as interruptive and unimportant. And if you put something important there, your readers will miss it. But in the 18th century, they put the verb at the end of sentences that went off a line after line after line after line because their intellectual model was not English but Latin. And in Latin, the verb comes at the end of the sentence. So they thought to have an elegant sentence, beautifully structured, they should imitate the Latin structure. Now, since we don't study Latin anymore, nobody's trained to wait for the verb at the end of
a sentence.
So
what do you tell them? What are some of the kind of quick rules? And I know that it is dynamic. You just said these rules change as usage changes. But what are some of the things we should pay attention to if we want to get it across?
I like to think of them as expectations instead of rules. The minute they become rules, they become rigid and you get into trouble. But still, in the spirit of what you've asked, there are five essential questions that a reader has to have the correct answer to at the end of reading every one of your sentences, if they are to make of that sentence what you wanted them to make of that sentence. If they get any one of these five wrong, they may have a perfectly fine interpretation, it's just not the one you, the writer, intended. The five questions are, what's going on here? What's happening? What's going down? Whose story is it? Or from what perspective should I be seeing all this stuff? Now, third is, how does this sentence connect backwards to the sentence I just finished reading? The fourth is, how is this sentence leaning forwards to where I might go from here? And the fifth and most important of these is, what are the words I should be reading with extra emphasis in this sentence because they're the stars of the show? Now, you get any one of those wrong, and you're in real trouble. You may come out with something, but not the thing the writer wanted. The new news that my discoveries have brought to the table is this, that we get the answers to those five questions predominantly, not from word choice or word meaning, but from word location. Hmm. Where a word turns up in a sentence will control most of the use to which it is put. So, for instance, with that last of the five questions, what's the most important thing here? In English, I claim, we give extra emphasis at any moment when the grammatical structure of the sentence comes to a full halt. That happens at a colon, a semicolon, or a period. And at those moments, readers tend to go, wham! I therefore advise people take the thing you want them to wham and put it in a place where the grammatical syntax is coming to full closure.
They'll bring it to an end, which is perhaps why we were always cautioned not to end on a preposition. Very weak word.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So why end there? So you, this is a kind of a theory that you worked out. You worked on it as a consultant, but you were also teaching in the classroom, started teaching English at Harvard in 1970. Tell us about your first day as a teacher.
Oh, what a memory. I lived 45 miles from Harvard, and I was very excited about the idea of teaching, and I think scared as well I should have been. And I got up that morning prepared with the syllabus. I was going to have my class. I go through the syllabus, and it was going to take 40 minutes, and I was going to let them out 10 minutes early, and they'd be delighted. Ha! And I noticed I didn't have any butterflies, no nerves. So I thought, well, I'm 45 miles away. By the time I get there, I'll have those. So I drove the 45 miles. I got to the part, no nerves. I thought, well, I got a long walk to the building. By then, no nerves. I've got to get down to the bottom floor. No nerves. I got to get to the end of the corridor. No nerves. I walk across the threshold of the room. No nerves. And I walked up to the front of the room, and I sat down. I passed out the syllabi, and I sat down. And I went through the syllabus. At the end of 40 minutes, I said, well, now, we'll get together again on Wednesday. See you then. And only then did I realize that for the entire 40 minutes, I had been staring at the toe of my shoe and the way it was lined up with the edge of a turquoise floor tile, which I had been contemplating for the entire 40 minutes. Mm. I had no nerves because I was absolutely numb.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen again. But that
did,
wait,
but you
terrible.
Also started thinking about, was that when you began to think about pacing and sort of what it means to actually teach, to be in front of people, and not to know your stuff, but to be able to put it across to a class?
I had done a little bit of stage, mostly Gilbert and Sullivan, so I knew something about how to project from stage that which you wanted somebody else to understand or hear or feel. And I knew that the idea here was that the student should come away with that which I had wanted to give them.
Right.
The question is, how do you go about doing that? After three classes, I felt I was doing so poorly that I really considered quitting. But I thought that probably wouldn't be fair to the students because it would be hard to find another teacher. So on the fourth day, I brought in a tape recorder. Now, back then, it was one of these big luggable reel-to-reel things, 45 pounds. And I plugged it in and started it going, and I told the students, don't worry about it. It's for me, not for you. And I went home and listened to that tape. I think it's one of the most painful experiences I've ever had. I was listening to it. It was so horrible. So I decided that there were so many things going wrong that the best I could do is choose the worst one and work on that. And the worst one had to do with pacing. So I worked on pacing for 3 weeks, 9 classes. And at the end of that time, I thought I was doing better, so I brought in the tape recorder again. And the pacing was all right, but it still was all terrible. So I took the worst thing on that tape and worked on that for 3 or 4 weeks and brought the tape recorder in again. I did that procedure for 3 years.
Something about, so let's take pacing, for instance. You recognize that something about your pace isn't right. Then what's your model? How do you get it right then?
I'm not sure if it's a model. It's clues. Mm-hmm. You get it right by looking at your students' faces and seeing if the eyes are starting to glaze over, if the attention isn't on you or what you're saying, if they are doodling in their notes instead of taking notes, if their body language. These are the clues you get for whether you've got them with you or not. And the important thing about pacing to control it is simply to vary it. Vary something, and it brings attention back to what you're saying. If you've been speaking with a low voice, go higher. A soft voice, go louder. A slow voice, go faster. Punctuate it with important things like accents. Every time the decibel meter spiked, I knew something important.
Yes, and Robin Copley falls out of her chair or is sitting over there in the engineering desk. But yeah, well, so now you're learning, and years later, a colleague asked you to analyze her teaching technique in the classroom, and did you use then what you learned at Harvard to help her?
No, I used what I learned from myself when I happened to be at Harvard. Harvard was a university at the time that, aside from the law school, it was not interested in teaching very much. It was interested in accepting you and then graduating you. And if you behaved like a Harvard person in between, everything would be fine. But teaching wasn't high on the list. I was a fifth-year graduate student. And had a reputation for caring a lot about teaching, which I did. And a first-time teacher, second-year graduate student, said, would you come to my class and observe and help me out? So I reluctantly agreed to do so. It was a Shakespeare class, and the two rectangular tables in the room were set together to make a large square. She sat on one of the four perimeters of the square, and her students were dotted around the other three sides. And she had to her immediate right a very talkative young man who looked very important and puffy, and he spoke not only often but at great length. During the class, one young lady to her left raised her hand three or four times, was never called on. Another was doodling ferociously on the paper. The paper's edges were curled up by the end of the hour. And a third actually fell asleep at one point. So when we retired to the coffee house after class for me to share my comments with her, I had 12 pages of notes and not a single sentence about Shakespeare, all about what the interaction in the classroom was all about. And the first thing I said to her is, I believe you are left eye dominant. She was somewhat surprised by that as an opening comment. She didn't know which eye was her dominant eye, so I gave her a quick test, which could tell anyone which is their dominant eye. One eye dominates and the other eye agrees. We don't see like Superman did with beams coming out of both eyes. And how did I know she was left eye dominant? Because the talkative guy was to her right. And when she turned to attend to him, she turned so that her left eye was on him, which meant that she had turned her head away from two-thirds of the class. She never saw the young lady raise her hand or the young doodler or the young somnolescent student and didn't know those things.
Well, once again, it's attention, and it's about awareness and opening your awareness to those things. You might have some native skills. You have to break those open and become even more aware, more broadly aware. You talked about Harvard and teaching. Was that you were teaching law students writing, right? This is after had you published your textbook
by
then?
Not at Harvard. I was a law student for 2 years. I then did law and the PhD in English simultaneously for 3 years, and then did 3 more years of English. So the 8 years that the 2 degrees should have been went on forever. In year number 5, my mother started saying to her friends, most Jewish mothers pray their son gets into Harvard. Me, I'm praying mine gets out.
Well, you did. And eventually Harvard did come knocking, right? Because you got a deal for your textbook. Is that when you came back to teach?
I got a deal for a textbook on it in 1980. The textbook came from my first job at the University of Utah, where the head of writing asked me to create a course in advanced composition for pre-law students. And in the course of trying to do that, I learned a good deal of what wasn't done and what hadn't been tried. And I published an article on the course. I published an article on writing programs at law schools, of which there were few, and then got a textbook, a contract from West Publishing, the number one legal publisher. So I wound up going into the market as a composition person. But Harvard brought me back to teach a course in their January term, 3 weeks, as I mentioned before, to 165 law students. about how to handle the English language better.
The students loved it. Harvard didn't. And we'll find out how that ended when my conversation with George Gopin, who is a professor emeritus of the practice of rhetoric at Duke University, that conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and my guest this hour is George Gopin. He's the creator of a writing theory called the Reader Expectation Approach, professor emeritus at Duke University. That approach led to a textbook. It brought you to the attention of the folks at Harvard. They brought you back where you had been a student for a long time and said and taught for a while, look, could you teach our law students about writing? And the students loved it, but apparently the university didn't. How did it go?
Well, I had 165 students every year, which made it tied it for the leading largest class, along with Roger Fisher's magnificent course in negotiations. And I got really, really good reviews. And at the end of the third year of this, the dean called me and said, Georgia, I read your reviews and they were fabulous. And I said, well, thank you very much. And he said, no, you don't understand. If the students liked you that much, they must not be learning anything. Hmm. And therefore, I checked into it and I find that you're not assigning, you know, reading. And I said, well, there's no reading to do on what I'm talking about. He said, well, I can't have this, and we're going to try the course one more year. You're going to assign an awful lot of reading, and if the reviews come back as strong as they were this year, we will discontinue the course. So I assigned 20 law review articles the next year, and the reviews improved, and he called and said, I'm sorry, your ratings went up, and we're therefore discontinuing the course.
Wow. So you really got fired. So you really just had to make this class really awful in order to...
I had to make it so they hurt.
And you did assign reading. So you go on, but this theory, again, it applies to law students, any professional or any student who's trying to get something across. You also do a lot of work now with scientists, right?
I do most of my work with scientists these days. Scientists need writing help more than anyone else because if they don't get those grants, they're no longer scientists. And those grant applications are not huge tomes. They're a few pages. And if they can't get their idea across clearly and with force so that the people who are reading scores of these things simultaneously will know and understand, then they don't succeed. So the scientists have welcomed these ideas with open arms, which is lovely. My favorite anecdote of all of that experience was standing in line, it's got to be 18 years ago or so, 20 years ago now, standing in line at the post office, a long, slow line, and the guy in two people in back of me says, Professor Gopin, and I turn around, and he's smiling at me, and I've had over 17,000 participants in my faculty workshops at Duke in the last 31 years. So there are a lot of people who know me whom I don't know. And he said, I've been meaning to write you a thank you note, but I've always been intimidated to write you anything. So I'm glad to be able to say thank you. And he described how he had been to my faculty workshop, which was 12 hours, and loved it and taken notes and put the materials away and closed the door and then completely forgot he ever knew me. And 6 months later, his chair brought him in and said, look, you're up for tenure in the fall, and we think you're fabulous, but you've never gotten a grant since you've been here. You failed several times. If I'll give it to you straightforwardly, you go one grant period left, you get your grant, you're tenured. You don't get your grant, you're out. So he had always called his scientific research administrator at NIH every time he got turned down for grant. And the SRA said, well, the writing was terrible. The writing was terrible. The writing was terrible. So he sat down and wrote what might have been his last grant proposal. And it didn't look different from anything else he'd done. And he said, I was near despair, but then I remembered you. So I took out all the materials and my notes, and I made a list of the major reader expectations and decided I would change any sentence that violated these expectations. Well, I had to change every single sentence in the grant. But not only did I get the grant, but the SRA called me and said, that's terrific. Congratulations. Who'd you get to write it for you?
Well, you talked about not, you know, in your Harvard class, not assigning reading because there's no reading that can help them. But to what extent is reading vital to this? In other words, reading good literature, good writing, helpful to the writer?
Reading good writing is about the only place you can go out and get these expectations consciously. I do not yet understand how readers have these expectations, because so much of what we read is either fiction and therefore not applicable to our professions, or is terrible writing. 95% of the stuff you read, stuff that comes over your desk as a professional, is not very well written. But I think reading good stuff gives you, if nothing else, a sense of flow, a sense of music, a sense of rhythm, and the sense of how things progress forward towards a goal. That's what good writing will make you do. Come forward with me towards a place. And when we get to that place, I'll tell you it's the place.
And you said that your love of music and understanding of music has helped inform you as a writer and as a writing teacher.
I think most of what I know about the language that's different from what other people preach about the language comes from classical music. I thanked my piano teacher when I published my book on expectations. I didn't quite know why at the time. I just knew I had to thank her. But it was from her that I began to learn about the stress position. I've just described it before but not named it. The stress position is any moment of full syntactic closure, any moment where the grammatical structure comes to a full halt, and readers give natural emphasis there. So my advice is put the thing you want a reader to emphasize there in the stress position, then 97% of your readers will agree that's stress-worthy. Well, I was studying with the wonderful Miss Esther Hughes when I was 7 years old, and at age, I think, eight, she assigned to me Beethoven's Für Elise. And I came in, having worked very hard during the week, and played for her. Ba da ba da ba da 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 ba da 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 ba da da da. And she interrupted me and said, "Now, George, it must move, it must flow, it must have motion. La da 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 dum, and then to there, and then to there." I can still hear her singing, "and then to there." That's the beginning of my concept of the stress position, that prose, like music, flow somewhere, and its sense of arrival is a sense of achievement.
So you've taken all these thoughts, you bundle them up, and then you hear a speech by George W. Bush. But I want to ask you this. First, I want you to tell the story about sort of being so appalled by this speech, and I'm curious to know why it took you until 2002 to notice. But tell us the story anyway.
It was actually in 2001. It was directly after 9/11.
Oh man, those are some bad speeches. Go ahead.
And President Bush was giving speeches from the Rose Garden to lift our morale. Yeah. These speeches were so badly written that nobody could have given them well. No matter what it is you might think of President Bush, you would have to agree that speech giving was not his forte. Okay, so you put those two things together, and I'm just dying inside as a rhetorician listening to this moment where pure rhetoric is supposed to be of help to the nation, and it's failing. So I wrote his right-hand man, Karen Hughes, a one-page letter with my credentials and saying, "The speeches are terrible. If you bring me to Washington, I can remediate the speechwriters, and then give me the president for an hour, and I'll show him how to read the speeches once they're well written. If you want to know what I'm talking about," it had to be a one-page letter, "here's a 14-page appendix in which I analyzed three paragraphs from the most recent Rose Garden speech, showed what was wrong with them, without changing the content, changed the way the words flowed, made them just fine. I then took the famous paragraph from Churchill's Dunkirk speech, 'We shall fight them on the beaches,' etc., and rewrote it as President Bush's speechwriter would have written it and ruined it." Gave some advice about what you had to do for the president to make it so that he would be able to read these speeches well. Well, they didn't bring me to Washington, but they did everything that I suggested in those 14 pages, and the speeches got immediately better, and he got much better at them. But a few weeks later, I got a letter from Congressman Tom DeLay, who announced that I was being recognized as one of the outstanding Republican small businessmen in the country. And I called his office and said, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a businessman. I'm kind of small, and one out of three isn't bad. But this, and they said to me, oh, sir, you must be a Republican small businessman, or we would not have so honored you. I was flabbergasted, beaten from my best argument. So I said, no, thank you. And they said, well, how about $3,000? They wanted $5,000 for this. Yeah. And I said, no. They said, how about $1,000? I said, no. A few weeks later, I heard from Tom Davis, who was chair of the National Republican Committee. I had been elected to the National Leadership Fellowship. That's a higher honor. The price went down, $2,000. I said, no, thank you. A few weeks later, Tom Davis again, you are now the newest member of the inner circle. I'm telling my students this stuff, and one of my students was a good Republican. He said, sir, this is no longer fundraising. That's a true honor. You are being honored. So I ignored it. And another letter, please come to this conference in Washington with Congress people and other outstanding Republican small businessmen like yourself. And I ignore it. And then another letter said, please come to the conference because we are delighted to inform you you have been chosen Republican of the Year for the state of North Carolina.
Wow. That's right.
There you have it.
There you have it. You may already be a winner. It doesn't matter what the party is. Well, now, so the speeches, you say they got better. I'll let you have that, I guess. We'll leave that to the listeners.
Better.
Well, here's the thing. Here's my question, though. You never understood what he was talking about. And even in the speeches, then you compare him to, say, a Ronald Reagan. And by the way, just to let you know, I'm an equal opportunity listener. I spent years on Capitol Hill going to hearings. As part of my job, listening to Ted Kennedy on the late Senator Kennedy, who was chair of the Judiciary Committee, and he never made a lick of sense to me either when he was talking off script. I never understood kind of what he was talking about, and George Bush. And yet the point is that these are guys who get elected. I mean, albeit legacy plays an important part of how they got where they were, because clearly neither one of those guys would be where they got without that kind of help. But people did vote for them. They liked them a lot, even though they made bad speeches. And it was pretty hard to figure out what they were talking about. So I guess context is everything, right? I mean, if you already are cheering for the guy, it doesn't make much sense. It doesn't make much difference, I suppose.
This is, in some cases, religious differences. That is, if you're born a Republican, you're a Republican. If you're born a Democrat, you're a Democrat. And there's a great deal of merchandising that goes on with political candidates. But I can show you great political speeches and compare them to bad political speeches and show you why the former are great and why the latter are not.
Do we care anymore about rhetoric? Does a great speech in the age of Twitter matter? Can we be persuaded in the way that we think rhetoric once was effective?
I think there's no question that the answer is yes. All you have to do is go back to last week in the Republican debate, and look at how fortunes were rising and falling, because Mr. Trump did a boisterous job in the first one, and his numbers went up, and then he looked a little bit disarmed in the second, and his numbers went down. And this lady who was head of Hewlett-Packard that so many people hadn't heard about is now everybody's favorite. I mean, this is because of the way they present themselves, and much of what their presentation is their rhetorical self.
But they're all, again, it's in a context. They're compared to each other. So now you're doing A-B comparisons. We know that the mind is not very good at doing A-B-C comparisons, so we're always kind of winnowing it down to two. You notice that the moderators in that case spent a lot of time asking how each of these candidates felt about what Donald Trump said about them. So now you're down to a binary. But the speech, you talked about the Dunkirk speech, the Gettysburg Address, one man or one woman addressing a crowd and using the best that rhetoric and writing have to offer. Can we still do that? Stand up in the context of your own and persuade listeners?
We can't do that right now at all, not because we haven't the ability, either as speech givers or speech listeners, but the two you've named come from the Civil War and World War II. We haven't got the political context of crisis, which gives rise to the need for great speeches and also to the effect that great speeches can have. So if you don't have that kind of context, you're not going to get great speeches. But rhetorical difference, if Mr. Gore had had a good rhetorician working for him, he would have won. If Mr. Kerry had had a good rhetorician working for him, he would have won.
He needed a Supreme Court working for him, too. That was part of it.
I think Hillary Clinton needs a rhetorician working for her.
But isn't it interesting that people who aren't, I mean, there was probably a time, I'm making this up, but probably a time in American politics where if you weren't a good rhetorician, you didn't get beyond, you know, city council, right? Now you
That's
can actually
correct.
Get to be a bona fide presidential candidate, and you can't make a speech.
Our voters, at least the educated ones, were brought up in an education system where they read great things and heard great things and were made to memorize great things and had an appreciation for what sounded good. We no longer have that. So that has
But I'm going to hold you to your own standard, though. What sounds good does change from age to age. You said 18th century writing wouldn't work for us, so the ear and the eye track differently these days.
It's true. What we have lost, I think, is the sense that the grandiose is good. That's the change that has happened, so that those kinds of set speeches would have a hard time finding. I mean, what's the greatest set speech in politics in the 20th century in this country? Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. If he didn't have that crisis, that human crisis, that speech couldn't have been written.
George, I submit to you that we have the crises all around us. We just don't have the spokespeople to, and maybe not the attention. And that's the other thing. I guess we'll end on that note. Our attention has become so fragmented among many platforms and much media that maybe it's just not being able to focus on a great speech that may have been made and we missed.
Entirely possible.
George Gopin, what a pleasure. Professor Emeritus of the Practice of Rhetoric at Duke, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more about our show and about the life and career of George Gopin and everything else we talk about at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.